Okay, welcome. This is Open the Pod Bay Doors. It is our weekly deep dive into the Australian and occasionally New Zealand tech and startup ecosystem. I'm one of your hosts, Ian Gardner, so along with Faden Stow, all the way from Hobart, we do this. On the side, we also run Innovation Bay, which is a tech community for entrepreneurs and those who love the sector. We couldn't do any of this without our sponsors, so I really do want to call them out. So we've got KPMG's High Growth Ventures, Macquarie Bank, and brand new off the blocks. And a big thanks to them is Commonwealth Bank, who's just come on. So they are our national sponsors. So we're actually down in Adelaide today. We're sitting in the Techstars HQ, so they've been active here for a little while. And I'm with Noel and Ben Schmidt, who run TeamGage together. So welcome, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, this is the first time we've actually had two guests on the show. So you were kind of kidding that, you know, buy one, get one free.
Yeah.
you guys are a husband and wife team.
Yes, we are.
And you launched TeamGage. So maybe, like, tell us a little bit about TeamGage, what the business does, and who your customers are. So just maybe a bit of background. So I don't know who wants to answer that.
Sure.
Okay.
You go.
All right, Noel, let's go. Ladies first.
So TeamGage is a software-led solution that helps large organizations create a culture of continuous improvement. So we do that by collecting anonymous real-time feedback from employees on a range of metrics that are important to the organization. And we give that data back to the teams themselves at every level. And they look at the data, they come up with their own actions and ideas and talk about the results and what we could try to get some better results. The software tracks those actions, they go and implement them, and then they measure it again. And so the idea is you're driving continuous improvement at every level. So it's really action orientated. And yeah, we've been in the market now for just over 2 years. I think May 2016 was when we launched with our first customer. And yeah, we're at 12 people now, and some of our customers are, so we work with NEC, Adelaide Crows is one, Microsoft, Santos, Oz Minerals, Bank of Queensland.
So these are all pretty big customers.
Yeah.
Typically, fairly. I mean, we feel like we provide increasing value the more number of employees you have. Not to say, I mean, we use it ourselves internally with 12 people, and we think it's really useful there as well. But yeah, certainly at the larger end of the scale, you've got. You know, a company that is potentially trying to shift, you know, go through a transformation that takes a significant amount of effort, and that's where we can really help to start to focus on those things.
Yes, I mean, ultimately it's about culture. I mean, that's kind of why I was keen to get you guys on. I mean, it's Entrepreneurs Week. We had an Innovation Bay event this morning with had John Henderson from Airtree in the panel. You guys came along, which was great. And then, Noel, you gave a pitch as part of the Entrepreneurs Week talking about culture and why it's important and what defines it. And but from my point of view, like, one of the fortunate positions in sitting on this side of the mic is that I do get to hang out with just a great number of exceptional tech founders, or the Innovation Bay dinners or breakfasts or anything else we do. And the common theme that always comes across to me is just is culture.
Yeah.
You know, so if you don't have, as a business, a clearly defined and rigorously enforced culture, you're not going to make it as a business.
Yeah.
So I thought it was really interesting. Like, and I also have been admiring from afar the progress of TeamGage. So I thought it was a really good chance just to talk a little bit about the business and why.
Yeah.
So maybe let's touch on the whole cultural piece. Like, why is culture so important, and why is it the determinant in some ways of success or otherwise of any business?
Yeah.
Look, I think, It is all pervasive. You know, every decision that is made within an organization happens in flow with the culture that exists. And you're spot on. If you don't focus on it, you know, you can run into disaster. But even if you don't define it, excuse me, or focus on it, you do have a culture one way or another. And for those companies that need to innovate but don't have a culture of innovation, they die. For those that should have, you know, an ethical overlay but don't, they get into trouble.
Can I just stop you there? Like, culture of innovation. I mean, it's like culture goes beyond just innovation.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I mean, culture can be anything. You know, we've got customers that are measuring their safety culture, for example. You know, if you've got miners, obviously a very dangerous occupation. And there will be, you know, between two sets of companies that do the same task, one of them has a focus where safety comes first in their teams and as part of their culture, they're going to have a much lower incident rate and be able to, you know, protect their people.
Yeah.
So it's just another example, but culture is pervasive in almost every aspect of business.
Yeah. It determines an organization's fate. And, you know, you can talk to any business leader, whether it's a startup through to global organizations, and it's sort of a unanimous answer to what is your biggest problem and challenge. And it always comes back to people, getting the people stuff right. When it's wrong, it's incredibly challenging to navigate through. It's stressful. It's time consuming. And when you get it right, it's incredibly powerful. So yeah, that's why TeamGage exists, because this is a huge problem. And there's a lot of tools that all measure culture and measure of the state of play in an organization, but there's a real lack of, you know, helping these organizations actually implement change and be action orientated and
have them actually do that themselves, drive that from within.
Yeah.
That's what we're really trying to do.
And have you got is there data that supports, you know, if you have a better culture or, you know, better enforced, you know, once you've articulated it, enforce it, that your performance as a business will be better?
Yes.
So you do have data. Like, is that your data or is that just existing?
No, so that there's huge research into this from, you know, Gallup and some of the largest research organizations in the world about a lot of it is around employee engagement, which is, you know, if culture's the way we work, employee engagement is the way employees feel about the way we work. And there's huge correlation between high employee engagement and bottom line. So, disengaged employees cost businesses billions of dollars globally. And obviously on the counter, engaged employees drive higher profit margins. And we're starting to see that now with our clients as well, where teams where their metrics are being pushed up is correlating to higher profits in those areas.
So. Yeah, we've actually got some good case studies that we're working on at the moment with just that, you know, teams that have managed to turn it around and, you know, have significant improvements in their culture and what they're measuring has reflected in better customer service or, you know, increased revenue for that particular unit.
Because that's like the holy grail for any company. It's like, hey, if you use us and you get the metrics that will come from that, I guarantee you'll make more money.
Yeah.
And there's lots of intangibles as well. And that's sometimes hard to, you know, sell that return. But, you know, things like advocating for the organization that you work for is much stronger when you're engaged with what you do. And that can lead to then that particular organization attracting other great people, because if you've got advocates out there in the market telling everyone else how good it is, that has flow-on effect to your business.
Yeah, culture's self-reinforcing. Yeah. So if it's a positive culture, you're attracting better talent because they see that, they want to be part of it. You then select people who are most aligned with that culture. And the other side of it is it actually weeds out, you know, people that don't align. When your culture's strong and someone doesn't fit with it, they want to leave because they don't fit in. So it's sort of self-reinforcing when you can get it going in the right direction.
And I guess the culture has to be good, because I mean, I can think of examples of bad culture. There's, you know, Enron or, you know, more recently Theranos. I mean, it's those were, you know, you could point to the culture in there, but it wasn't necessarily a good thing.
Yeah. But that's the thing, you might have said it before, like, whether you define and create your culture or not, you'll still have a culture. So best define it and create it to be the one you want it to be, rather than let it happen by default. Yeah. And
what you allow becomes the standard that you set.
Yeah.
And I guess it's, I mean, all other things being equal, this sounds like an obvious thing to say, but the earlier in your process you define it, the better it is.
Yeah, definitely.
Like, because a lot of the listeners to this podcast are startups. So like, what message would you have for our listeners when it comes to culture?
Yeah. So build it from the ground up. It's so much easier to do that. We work with clients every day who, you know, the big problem we're helping them with is how, when you've already got a culture in motion that might not be the one you want, how you sort of stop that energy, turn it around and get it going in another direction. So, Yeah, building it from the ground up. I mean, my talk this morning was about how you do that and, you know, this idea that early on, I guess you're really thinking about product, delivering product, MVP, releasing as quick as possible, getting customers, making sales. And it's easy not to think about culture because it doesn't feel like that's helping those goals that you're working on in an early stage. But if you take the time early on to define your culture and start creating systems and processes to live it and embed it, as you grow, it that momentum builds. And when you're larger and you're 10 and you're 20 and you're 100 people, that positive culture that you've created has built a lot of momentum, and it can make a company unstoppable, just in the same way that a bad culture and the momentum in a bad culture can destroy a company.
Yeah. Well, it's like you said this morning, the first 10 people you hire are likely to be the ones that set your culture initially without great difficulty in shifting it afterwards. So getting the recruitment process right is really important. You know, we talk a lot about agonizing over not hiring people who have the right skill set or, you know, really great skill set that we need desperately but don't have a culture fit. And it just, it's so easy to go, well, you know, it doesn't matter. We just need this right now. But long term, it'll come back and bite you.
It's toxic. It's like a cancer. Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly right. And it spreads, right? And then the good people that you already have eventually leave because of what you've allowed to take place. Yeah.
And is it, so, like, I mean, like, thinking about your bigger customers, so you know, touched on some banks and Microsoft and some other big corporates. And is it better, you know, are they coming to you with the problem of we need to change our culture, or are they coming to you with, well, our culture is pretty good, we just need to make sure that, you know, new people coming on are, understand it and we can measure it? I mean, so which of those are?
I think it's all of the above. Right. So we have a really diverse range of clients where they have an exceptional culture, and so they're really passionate about this from leadership down, and they want to use TeamGage to keep improving that, keep it where it is and keep driving it forward, right through to companies where it's really bad. They've, you know, maybe been doing some annual surveys for a while and the results haven't been good and maybe been going down over time and they don't know what to do. The way they've been trying to manage this hasn't been working. And for them, they're really starting from a very, very low baseline of, you know, employees not even wanting to submit feedback because there's zero trust in the organization.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, I think it also feeds into this idea of feedback going into a black hole. You know, we see that a lot with clients who do an annual survey, or even if they're doing shorter pulse surveys, it's the same issue of, well, why do I keep submitting and nothing changes? That is actually more demoralizing than just not asking at all. But, you know, going back to your question of who's the customer, I think often it is a larger organization that's going through change as well. I think that's a really great time to start working on this. Well, exactly, right? You know, you can't afford to sit still anymore. Yeah. But, you know, these companies who are going through like a merger, or for example, like the worst thing I can hear from a company going through something like that is, well, look, we just want to get through this first and then we'll start measuring this stuff and improving it after. And that's just totally the wrong philosophy, because it's while you're doing that merger, it's while you're implementing the change that you need to know, right? I mean, we've known this in software for ages. If you use that agile cycle and get things right with customer feedback as you're making changes, you come out with a much better product. There's no different with culture. But yeah, so you've got to change that mindset from let's worry about this later and, you know, tackle it then.
Yeah.
I do just want to add one thing. So we've been talking about culture fit, and I know there's a lot of been talk lately around we should be talking about culture alignment. When we at TeamGage talk about culture, we're talking about, you know, an organization's purpose and the values and the framework that they want people to work together, not socially culture, not sort of, you know, certainly not, you know, things like a bit of a bro culture and things like that. That's not what we're talking about, those social dynamics. It's very much about the purpose of an organization and the values that they've put in place for employees to work within. And so when we talk about culture fit, we're talking about, cultural alignment with those things. And you can be from any diverse background. Obviously, that's, we know that's better to have more diversity.
Well, a diversity of thought as well is great and strengthens your vision and strengthens your values. It's just about being aligned on what's important in terms of those values. That's a big deal.
You can bring in a team of people who are all a culture fit or culturally aligned, however you want to phrase it, who are incredibly diverse.
Yeah.
I just want to make that distinction.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. And like, and you also talked this morning, I mean, it was almost like that Simon Sinek, I think it was, that famous YouTube talk where he talks about the why, how, what.
Yes.
And you had elements. I mean, do you want to touch on that and how it applies to this cultural question?
Yeah. So, you know, I was talking about how to build a culture from the ground up, and you have to start with your why, and that's really your purpose. Companies need to define their purpose. We, you know, ran through this morning, like Airbnb, their product is accommodation, but their purpose is about creating a sense of belonging anywhere in the world. And that's their why, and that's your sort of, you know, guiding force in everything you do.
And you had quite a good one for TeamGage too. Like, so what's the
TeamGage why? We want to create a culture of continuous improvement in every workplace.
Yeah.
So, you know, we talked about this morning that a purpose is not a goal. It's never something that can be ticked and done, but it has to be your reason. And we certainly do what we do because we want to see every workplace being somewhere where people come together, communicate, come up with ideas and can implement them. And it's okay if it doesn't work. You measure that and then you go back and try something else. So the idea is that you're trying and continuously improving in the right direction.
Yeah.
I'd just add like something you mentioned this morning as well about culture can sometimes seem very fluffy.
Yeah.
And sort of it's that HR thing that everyone kind of goes, you know, okay, roll your eyes. But I think when we talk about culture and we talk about what we measure, it's very targeted and tangible things. They're not, you know, they could be operational. We talked about safety before. That's something not sort of like, how do we all feel today? It's about something really important and really tangible to that unit. So when we work with each customer, they'll be looking at very different things. We're not prescriptive on, you know, you need to measure this. Well, that's best practice to measure that. It's not, well, no, what's important to you? What are you changing at the moment?
Yeah.
And let's work on that.
But within the, I mean, I'm even thinking of Amazon, for example, like, you know, 14 leadership principles starting with customer obsession and a bunch of other things. So, but it's quite hard to define, you know, he's a, you know, 7.2 out of 10 in customer obsession, or she's a, you know, 3 out of 10 in bias for action or whatever that number is. So, yeah, how does one quantify the, you know, put those metrics around those cultural values? And is that even sensible to think about doing?
Yeah.
So I think this is where we use a lot of anchor pointing to try and normalize that data. So in terms of, what
so anchor point being what? Like one so individual when, who yes. exposes it?
So when we ask, guy? Well, yeah, when we ask a question, we would say, you know, okay, well, here's the ratings, but this is what this rating means. This is what this rating means. So you sort of, you have a benchmark point to go, okay, so, you know, if we're measuring safety, it's absolutely always my top priority, or, you know, I think about it mostly, but sometimes it slips, or, you know, just being able to actually, normalize that for each individual response. And then the data that comes out is more structured.
Yeah.
And the idea is, you know, so much about, being in a workplace where it's great to work is being able to openly communicate what's working, what isn't. And so, you know, obviously TeamGage, people are scoring metrics and, you know, answering questions on how much priority are we actually giving safety? We talk about it a lot, but am I being pressured to deliver by a certain time frame, or am I given the space to sort of go, no, we need to stop and there's a safety issue here? And, So much of that is actually empowering employees to talk openly about those things, and where there's an issue, raise it and have management step in if needed. And if not, the team themselves might be able to change it. And so I think that measurement, it's not also a lot of our clients when they first come on board get really fixated on the number and what does that number mean? And then as they start to embed the process, I think they're a lot more interested in the trend line.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you can start from a really low point okay, that's the reality of your situation. Now what can you put in place to get it moving up?
Yeah.
And that should be celebrated every step of the way. And, you know, we also see things as well, depending on what you're measuring, outside forces, so market factors, you know, political climate, things like that can affect certain metrics. So it's not always about always being at a really high level and staying there. It can be how adaptable and resilient your organization is to the challenges that they have to face.
Yeah.
But also even on the positive results, it's about what are we doing right to get that result, you know, or what is it that can still take us to that next level? And bottling that up, you know, a lot of what's great about our tool within a large organization is that we can compare and go, okay, this area seems to have gotten this right. What is the magic that's happening in that team that we can then spread across? So, you know, that's helping to kind of foster those discussions that can go across what are normally silos.
Yeah. Support for Innovation Bay and Open the Pod Bay Doors comes from our global partner, High Growth Ventures, KPMG's dedicated startup team who work with founders, providing them with the tools and insights required for sustained high performance.
All right. Can we talk a bit more about the business?
Sure.
So, I mean, you said you started, what, 2016? I mean, what was the genesis of this? Like, how did you guys think it up and get it started?
We both had some interesting experiences in some large companies where, you know, great brand, great team, but for whatever reason, underperforming or really high churn rate of staff. And I think what we both saw there was something that we didn't actually know was in the data until we found out later, but that 4 out of 5 people who leave an organization could have stayed with simple manager action.
Okay.
And that, you know, we went through a lot of research to get to this point, but essentially we discovered that the biggest issue was just a lack of communication and action. Right? That's as simple as that. It didn't have to be anything incredibly complex.
So are you working in the same bad business?
No, right? different companies.
Different companies.
And having spoken
to
people.
Want to name and shame who
they are. No, we won't do that.
I might have to remove it from my LinkedIn profile.
But as I say, we find even within a large organization, you get a lot of variability. You know, both of those organizations would have had great teams elsewhere.
Yeah.
Right? It wasn't necessarily the whole organization that was to blame, but there was just a lack of good communication. And that's where we sort of started from. And almost anyone you speak to who's worked in large corporate will have a similar story.
Bad cultures are everywhere.
Yeah.
So we'd both worked in one and we're just like, this shouldn't be that hard. I think that was sort of where like that first idea came from. Like we could build something to improve this.
Mm. And just as a reminder, like, so you are a husband and wife. So my suspicion is you're both in relatively well-paid, you know, I'm using quote marks here, cushy corporate jobs. You had a family as well at the time, or is that?
No. Well
yes.
So, hang on.
Yeah, the timelines get confusing here. So, yes, we were. I had left my job earlier than Noel. We had another business prior to TeamGage.
Together?
So, yeah. Noel joined what I was doing.
I was the safety net, later. So he could go and take risks, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, as it was.
That's kind of where I'm getting to, because, I mean, doing any startup is risky. Doing any startup as a couple is risky. Doing any startup as a couple with a family in the way is, I mean, like, you have just taken the risk profile associated with startups and dialed it to
bring it on.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so we'd already had that first business experience up our sleeves to know how crazy we were for doing it again. But we did it anyway. But no, I think that was, you know, invaluable to kind of learn the ropes early on. And then we had our daughter and we'd been working on this idea for some time prior to launch. Very on and off because, you know, funding and all the rest of it, we just sort of had it on the back burner and we put together some beta trials, did a lot of research, but it took a long time to kind of get to the point of going, okay, we're ready to do this and launch. But once we did that, it was kind of full steam ahead.
Yeah. And I got pregnant while we were in like MVP development phase. So in a weird way, our daughter Zara's kind of been paralleled growing up with TeamGage. So that was super challenging as well though, because I think, you know, I was a bit unwell through the pregnancy and then obviously with a newborn and trying to get a company off the ground. It was super challenging. But you know.
So, I mean, everything you've talked about is super challenging, like a startup, being married, having kids. Yeah, it's just that then you put them in this pressure cooker of a brand new business, and it's just, and you guys are superhuman.
Well, I don't know about that.
Thank you for saying so, but it doesn't feel like we're in, you know, we couldn't fall apart. You've got to take some time every now and then, just take a breath and go, okay, you know, we can reset and come back.
But what made you think it was going to work? Like, what were the signs? Because you obviously did some research before you jumped feet first into this. So, like, what was that?
So, yeah, I mean, market research. We did a couple of things back to front. So we did launch a first MVP. We did some trials in the US. They didn't go well, went quite badly. So then we went back to the drawing board and did a lot more market research before we essentially developed a second MVP.
So when you talk about this, was a tech. So you basically built some tech.
Yeah.
How did you do that? Like, just maybe a quick sidebar. Yep. What did that tech look like?
I was basically the tech person for that at the time.
You're a developer. So.
So
you basically whipped it together at evenings.
Spare time. We then, when we went through kind of the final cycle, we had a bit more of a team around us, which was great. So we would have, you know, designer and developer as well. So, that sort of pushed out at us when we did our commercial launch. But yeah, it was a lot of just in between, like you say, just finding, you know, we knew the research was there. We were really confident on that. And the one thing that we saw from the industry was that they were, there's a lot of parallels to the software industry in the sense of they were still, you know, the HR industry generally was still stuck in waterfall mode where it's like, you know, do this, measure it, design a big program, implement that. The whole cycle is sort of 18 months. And then we find out whether the customers or the employees like it. And often they miss the mark. So we thought, well, why wouldn't we bring a much more agile approach to this, which clearly worked with software to people as well?
I think we were like, you know, early on, like the first MVP went quite poorly and I think we had the wrong approach. And I think that was probably just a little bit of stubbornness in us that we're like, this is still a massive problem and the way we approached it didn't work. So we need to go back to the drawing board, but we still believe there was a huge opportunity to solve this problem. So we basically kept going, kept trying until, you know, we found a product that could deliver that value and solve that problem in the way.
That mix of unwavering belief, but the ability to be brutally honest about what's going on in front of you. So it's like, this can work. It's not working right now, but it can, you know, so that was kind of what happened.
All right. We should probably talk a bit about Techstars. I mean, we are in the office here and that's when I first met you just over a year ago. So, I mean, Techstars is an aerospace. I mean, it's got, certainly for Adelaide, I mean, Techstars globally has got various different focuses, but in Adelaide in particular, it was defense. An aerospace and defense focus. Yeah. And there was, you know, drone companies, there were,
cyber security.
Yes, there was like Wi-Fi. I mean, there was some incredible deep tech coming across. And then you guys walk into the room and say, we're going to fix culture. There's a little bit of a disconnect from when we saw you. So do you want to just explain how you managed to, convince the Techstars guys that you were right for their program?
Yeah. Well, I guess we applied just like every other company. Obviously, in our application, we put a bit of a pitch in there that there's been some recent culture papers that have come out from the defense industry around the huge cultural problems they're facing. And they had, you know, strategic plans on how to improve that. And so, you know, we talked about this is an industry that is facing immense challenges, technology, the rate of change and the security threat that's posing. This is a space that needs to be incredibly adaptive and innovative at speed. And you need a good culture that fosters that, a culture that can improve where people are open and communicating and driven towards a purpose. And, you know, they need more diversity. That's something openly that defense has said and a lot of the private companies around the space as well are saying we want to improve diversity. And so there was actually a lot of reason why we were very relevant. But yeah, I don't know. We believed that. I'm not sure that the people that were selecting believed that through the process. So I think there was a bit of convincing. We got asked that question a lot repeatedly, and we really had to be able to justify it. But one of the things I would say, so we did get in. We were really lucky to get in. I think, you know, they sort of, so Textos
sure
says.
Like, you're pretty talented, so yeah, let's not do like too much of a service here.
But, keep going. You know, they do talk about like team, or founder, and then other things, but they look for that first. So I'd like to think they saw us and the potential in us, even if the product was, you know, maybe the corporate partners are like, why do we need this? And, but I think that we had great validation on the first, within the first week. The CTO of Thales, which is a, you know, huge global defense company.
And they're one of the supporters, or what are they called?
Yeah, corporate partner of the program. So he flew in and did a, you know, sort of fireside chat. And one of the other companies said, so you're the CTO, what's your biggest challenge? And he sort of started talking about drones and, you know, how much of a problem that's creating for them. And then he stopped himself and said, actually, I take all that back. Our biggest problem is people. Managing people in a large organization is super challenging. And I just sat there. I'm like, this guy's the CTO. Yes, we're in the right place. And I mean, that just speaks to what we hear every day from our customers. But yeah, I think I'm glad that happened in week one, because I think I was probably a little unsure of our fit, even though I believed it inside me. It was, you know, looked around at all these companies that were, deep tech hardware, building rocket thrusters. So that was nice to hear in week one.
Yeah. And that's why I wanted you guys on, because, you know, the big end of town, the big challenge is often people, but small end of town, the startup world, the biggest opportunity is also people.
Yeah.
You know, so if you get that right, then that is the rocket fuel. And you just use the rocket analogy and talk about space, but it's the rocket fuel to make your thing work.
Yeah.
Which is amazing.
Absolutely.
All right. So the quick question on the role. So Ben, you're CEO, Noel, COO. How did you decide these roles?
That's a good question. So I think we went through a book called Scaling Up by Vern Harsh. We went through EO Accelerator program as well. And one of the things they talk about is setting. It's very, very good. Yeah. Encourage anyone who is interested to have a look at it. But they talk about the functional accountability areas.
Yeah.
And so we kind of divvied those up in the ways that we thought matched our skill set best. So that's kind of where we landed to our real responsibilities.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, my role is COO, but right now that means, we both work on strategy as the founders, but, sales, finance and marketing, that's a fairly big portfolio, but you know, that's sort of my functional areas. I also just want to say, for the record, have it out there. Obviously Ben is our CEO, and we sat down and talked about that in terms of head of company. And I truly think that, you know, based on where we're at, we're not building a startup, we're building a global company. And based on our split, we're a tech company. At our heart, our product is software as a service. And I just want it to be said that I agreed and encouraged for Ben to be CEO. He didn't push me away from that. I just want that to be on the record.
It's a critical decision, you know.
Yeah.
You could have gone co-CEO. I mean, that's been done before. Most people think it doesn't work, and then you look at Lassie and go, actually, there's a bit of a notable exception in that one.
Yeah,
yeah, absolutely.
I think we needed a tiebreaker. So, like, you know, we have strong opinions and we'll debate things, but someone needs to be able to, at that point, sort of go, it's my call, and then we get behind it. And I think that's probably why we moved away from Codes.
So, and 12 people currently in the team. So what sort of functions are they in? What are they doing?
So we've got, obviously got a technical team. So developers, quality assurance. Roughly half.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds quite normal.
About that. We've also got a designer, a couple of sales, and, just hired a new customer success role, which is really exciting for us.
Okay.
So really, you know, making sure that was a great role to hire, because I was able to just say to him, your mission in life is to have our customers extract the maximum value they can out of what we offer them, right? And very rarely do you get an opportunity to have a role that is that clear.
Yeah.
So that's really exciting. And we've got, I guess implementation support as well.
So it's a bit of a mix. We've sort of traditionally been heavy on the tech talent in our, more tech roles, which I guess goes to the nature of our product and what we've built. But, yeah, it's exciting now building out more of the customer side and looking at the opportunity we have there as well.
And so let's talk about the business model. So how do you make money? What sort of packages? How much does it cost?
Yep. So it's software as a service, so license subscriptions. We charge annually for licenses, and pricing starts for under 100 licenses at $120.
So license being one user, one staff member?
Sorry. So every employee they want to have on the system using it is a license.
Okay.
It starts at $120 a user, a license per year for under 100. Yep. And then scales as you go up in volume of licenses.
Okay. And how's it going?
Good.
Is that just a flat rate? So you have no tiered pricing for different sizes or different people?
Well, it just scales. So the per head cost comes down the larger the organization gets.
Right.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah. And how do you know you got the pricing right?
that's a good question. John Henderson spoke about that this morning.
Most VCs do.
It's really tricky.
It is very tricky.
People are buying it, so we know it's not too high. Could we be charging more? Yeah. That's always a question. We believe we provide incredible value to our customers. So, I don't know if you ever know if you've got it right.
Mm-hmm. And do you roll in extra stuff? A lot of SaaS businesses will have consulting pieces, and I'm sure you guys could make good money from consulting, but have you gone down that path?
Not yet. We really focus on actually trying to automate as much of the implementation process as possible. But we do think there are some really good opportunities. So at the moment, for example, we would have suggestions in our system for, okay, your metric is this, here's something to try. But we see there's an opportunity there probably for a marketplace at some point in the future to then bring specialty providers. Because obviously being global as well, we either have to set up our own consultancies all around the world, or we can partner with some great ones that already exist. And that's probably a faster option for us and a better one long term. Yeah. So there's definitely some opportunities there to expand that offering.
Yeah. And on the funding front, beyond the Techstars money, and I can't remember, what was the, how much did they put in?
$20,000 US. There was a convertible note as well.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can take a convertible note as which is the extra 100.
Yeah.
Yep.
We didn't take that.
Right. So basically, the punchline there is you have not really taken any funding. So I suspect you funded it out of your own pocket and now you've got enough revenue. So you must be at break even or close to.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
That's amazing. You're not long in, you've got 12 staff, you're break even. So you don't need funding right now. And is that, who wants to talk about the philosophy of that and what you think, how you're thinking about that?
Yeah.
Because this is unusual for this show. In fact, the whole thing about this this particular episode is unusual, but I think it's a great story.
Yeah.
I like it.
Well, look, I think we've been really focused on customers and just obtaining customers. That was our red hot, goal initially. And every time we sort of thought about funding, we thought about it certainly near the end of the program with Techstars. It's kind of been,
Did you have offers?
Yeah, we did have some informal offers and some things on the table, but it got to the point of, well, we can go down this path and keep pursuing this and spending time on this, or it would always just be that these one or two big deals would drop in our lap and we'd go, we should probably spend time on that instead, And so that's been to date. It's always kind of ended up down that path. As you said, every dollar that we earn just gets reinvested back to, when's the next person we can hire?
Yeah.
So that's the mode that we've been in for a couple of years. Having said that, we're certainly still open to doing a round. And I think now that we're maturing, we can see the benefit of supercharging the systems that we've built.
Yeah.
You know, we sort of see that cycle now where we can just make it bigger and things go better.
Yeah.
So it's not something that we've said no to. It's just to date, this has been the best path.
And I think as well for us, so, you know, having a company before, we knew how to sell and build a product people like, and so that was kind of default for us, was you make money by selling a product that provides value and then look after your customers. And so that was sort of, that seemed like the normal approach. Funding kind of seemed like, oh, that's outside of what we know and what we've done. And so I think from the beginning, like, you know, rather than using angels or anything, we're just like, well, let's just provide something that people will pay for. That's a great way to make money.
And we're also really confident in our future, in the sense that, you know, I don't mind putting our, you know, money on the line, in terms of if a bank gives us a loan, that's fine. I'll pay it back. It definitely is going to get paid back because I can see the path, you know. If we invest it here, it's going to come out there. We've always had that level of confidence that we can do that. It's not, I don't know, somehow, and probably just deluding ourselves, but it doesn't feel like a risk, you know. It's not like the money that goes in is going to disappear. And, of course, it could, things change. But, yeah, we've had that level.
Yeah.
Innovation Bay is brought to you by our friends at Macquarie Group. Macquarie is a diversified financial group providing clients with asset management and finance, banking, advisory and risk, and capital solutions across debt, equity and commodities, with offices in all major financial hubs across the world.
And so, I mean, let's talk about Adelaide, and, you know, the fact, you know, Adelaide is not, it's the capital of South Australia, but it's not really the capital of Australia. It's not as big in the startup sense as Sydney or even Melbourne.
Yeah.
What's it been like launching your business in Adelaide, and what's been the, you know, maybe touching some of the tough challenges you've had being here?
I mean, I think the answer is great and challenging at the same time, which is, I guess, not a surprise. The great things about it are, you know, there is a community here that has grown, particularly in the sort of startup ecosystem, which didn't exist, you know, 10 years ago. There was just none of that. But now there are some really supportive people. And I think you can, because it is a smaller community, you can stand out and get help. You know, there's be a lot of noise in the community in larger cities. I think the lifestyle here is very attractive. So the staff that we do get, you know, enjoy a really great standard of living here. Most of our team have kids, and they can, you know, be in an environment where bringing up a family is easier to do.
I just want to add, that's important, right? Like, I like to think that our employees are more resilient and can handle more because they're also well balanced with, you know, outside of work, family, and, you know, that support network creates a lot more resiliency than, you know, if we had people that had left their family and were trying to look after kids at home without family support. And so I think that's an important point. The lifestyle in Adelaide does actually make people, you know, arguably a little bit more resilient, right? Because I can, you know, walk down the block and I'm in nature and in a park, and all those things help unload stress.
Oh, and you're not spending 2 hours to get to work on a train or whatever. It's close.
Yeah. So sorry, keep going.
No, that's all right. And so, look, I think that's the positives are certainly there, and we've had a lot of great support. The negatives, it is harder to find talent at times just because the pool is smaller.
Specifically, what are you going to say?
Yeah, I think specifically around specialized roles. So as we get larger and we need to sort of fill out our executive team, there aren't that many people in South Australia that have had enterprise SaaS experience, for example. So that's going to be a challenge.
SaaS to enterprise.
Right.
What other companies in Adelaide have, you know, trained those people up for us?
Yeah, it's a very small pool. So that's a challenge. And I think, you know, I was going to say a lack of customers here, in the sense that most of the larger corporates that we deal with have a base in Sydney or Melbourne. But even that, to be honest, is not that big of a deal. I mean, we jump on a plane these days. It's not far away.
Easy.
Yeah. And we do a lot of, you know, teleconferencing and stuff. It's a lot easier than it used to be.
Well, I think it's made us stronger because we've had to be, you know, have systems that can be scalable, or, you know, like selling remotely, supporting remotely. Yeah. That's kind of been in our DNA from day one, because we were selling to interstate clients from day one. And then it's like, well, now we're getting our overseas customer base. It's not as big of a jump for us because we've been doing that. So I think it's, there are strengths in that as well.
Agreed. Yeah, and I've heard, you know, even just being here for the last day and a half, you know, a bit of complaining about, you know, there's no capital in Adelaide. And, you know, it tends to be that's, you know, and again, this is no slight against Adelaide, but in the more immature startup ecosystems, there's, you know, this perception that money should fall from the trees and fall on your lap. And, you know, so, well, one, you guys don't need the money. We've already established that, but... You know, any comment on that and the lack of capital? You know, because John from Airtree's here, and a lot of the VCs are interested in Adelaide, and, you know, Blue Sky got a fund away last year.
Yeah, look, I think we probably have a bit of a skewed view on that as well. Having gone through Texas, we've had a lot of exposure.
Yeah.
So we've been introduced to a lot of people that maybe others haven't been. But I would say, I agree that, you know, you can't expect money to just be handed out to you for any idea. You've got to go pretty hard for it. But, you know, probably the one thing that we could do better here is educate the sort of the angel level investors about the newer markets. So as I think Adelaide has been typically very property focused investors, or, you know, that older money who understand buying bricks and mortar, but really haven't been educated on some of the other ways that you can invest. So I think, you know, I don't know what the answer to that is, but to be able to educate them and bring them along to some of the newer ventures that can be lucrative for them would be beneficial.
Yeah.
I'm debating. I could say something that might be a bit controversial here.
Oh, come on, you're saying
it. Well, you're committed to it now.
Let's go.
So we were bootstrapped, so I'm obviously a bit biased, but I fundamentally don't like that talk here or elsewhere of, you know, why the government should give more grant money and things. Cause it's like, you know, we're here to build businesses and solve problems and provide value to customers. Why is that the government's role to, like, you know, business should be able to, you should be able to find first customers. You can build MVPs. And obviously I'm talking about software here. I know that hardware, there are definitely companies that need upfront capital, but I think it makes, if your software makes you a stronger company from day one, if the less money you have, right? The less money you have, the more focused you have to be, the faster you have to be at executing, the more strategic you have to be with every dollar you spend. And that, the lessons you learn going through that, I think makes you better founders and makes your company more focused and efficient. So, yeah, I don't know. I think, you know, controversial, but maybe there should, you know, be less money on the table because, you know, are we doing a disservice for making it so much easier? And then when you get to the next level, have you learned everything you've needed to learn as a business?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm sort of an advocate of the efficient market hypothesis. So, you know, money will find the talent at the right level to support, you know, the whole supply demand piece. So,
yeah.
I mean, my view of Adelaide is there is money here. I mean,
like,
there has been some great companies funded, you know, like, you know, Fleet, Mariota, Sign. I mean, they've all done well with funding rounds. And, you know, so there's no lack of capital. And I think, you know, the whole venture community will find the talent when it needs it.
Yeah.
All right. Look, I think we're kind of at time. We should jump on to the quickfire, right? Anything else that, did we miss anything on culture? Anything you want to add around what we said? Or should we just do the quickfire?
Let's do the quickfire.
I think we're good. Yeah.
I've never done a double quickfire round.
Okay.
So I don't know whether it takes double the time, but.
All right.
All right. So book.
Scaling up.
That's mine. If we're talking business, scaling up.
You take scaling up. I'll take Made to Stick.
Okay.
Very good book about how to get messaging across.
Okay. So is it marketing focus or?
It's sort of life focused, but yeah, marketing as well. It's about how to communicate a message. Yeah. So marketing, certainly part of it, but really any message, internal, external.
And are you guys avid book readers?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah. Scaling Up by Vern Harnish, like the textbook for scaling up. So I love that. But yeah, we read books all the time.
Good. The podcast, remember when I asked you this, you were like, oh, I don't know what to say because I love so many. So like, what's your favorite podcast?
Freakonomics for me.
Okay.
I enjoy that.
So I'll give you two if that's allowed. So yeah, business would be SASTA. Just think it's great learnings there. You know, being in Adelaide, don't get to talk to a lot of other SaaS companies. There's not a critical mass here yet. So I love that. But also, for non-business, 10% happier. It's actually not about happiness. It's actually about meditation, but it's called 10% happier. And, I love that one.
And you did disclose, Noelle, that you were an occasional listener to this show.
So of course. I thought that's a given.
Open the pod bay and then.
I do love it.
No, that's good. You seemed pretty happy when I asked you this morning if you wanted to come on, which is good. It was always nice to be flattered.
Pretty excited, yeah.
Do you have a favorite app?
Ooh, that's tricky.
Okay, so... Again, the 10% Happier app, which is a guided meditation app. I love it.
How often do you use that?
I try to do it every day.
Right.
I
struggle with meditation. I just find it, I fall asleep. And I don't know whether that's a good thing or not, but, since I started I heard this lecture on how to meditate better, and those techniques that they taught you about how to get into that state. Yeah. Are guaranteed to make me fall asleep.
Oh, really?
So I just use it to fall asleep whenever I want it. Amazing.
The trick is to get to sit upright as best you can.
Yeah.
And that keeps you a bit more attentive. Yeah, stand's good as well. Stand's good. You can do walking meditations as well.
Okay.
I just found it transformational.
No, I'd agree with that app. Otherwise, I don't know, YouTube, NBA app. Always checking
out. Okay, nice. I meant to ask this before, the news source. Like, what do you rely on?
Twitter?
Me too. That's probably, it's good.
Depending on who you follow, I guess. It could get led up the garden path.
Do you have a favorite tech founder?
For me, it's Elon, just because I think he, in many ways, is a deeply flawed human being like the rest of us, but has just gone out and done some really crazy, amazing, great stuff that as a nerd, I'm like, yes, let's do that. But also I like that sort of there's the exposure of the ups and downs of his world, because it shows me that everyone's human, but he can
see. Because he's still young. I mean, he's got 30 years to keep changing the world. So it's pretty amazing what he's been doing.
Absolutely.
And you, Noelle?
Other than Ben.
Good answer. Good answer.
Yeah, that is a good answer. I love it.
Because this used to be a CEO, was it, or not?
Oh. Yeah, we changed it to founder in case.
Okay.
You can answer it how you like.
All right. This is not a founder, but I'm going to say Satya Nadella as the CEO of Microsoft because, from a cultural point of view, I love – he came in with a new vision for the company, and it's been quite transformational the way they've changed their culture and then, their business model essentially because of it. And I don't know, obviously with the clients we work with, it's great to see a leader who has a vision and has the skills and ability to actually roll it out across thousands of employees.
I think it's been one of the biggest and most impressive cultural transformations in corporate history because he's done it in a quite short amount of time.
I love his talk about empathy and growth mindset and,
Have you met him?
No.
No.
Can you hook that up? Anyone listening, hook that up.
Microsoft.com. I don't know. All right. So this is our new question. Favorite productivity tool. What do you use to?
At the moment, for me, it's Microsoft To Do, just because it's extremely simple to-do list, but somehow having it in front of me just.
And it probably synchronizes any device.
Exactly. The simple one's the best for me.
Yeah. You got to say TeamGage, don't you?
Again, of course.
Yeah. Given.
Given.
TeamGage, we're hyper users of our own tool and it definitely works. Look, we're growing.
Yeah.
Other than TeamGage, I'll go with Pipedrive. So that's our sales CRM, but we track actions and tasks and emails and we'd be lost without it.
So that's separate to, it's a competitor to Salesforce or something like that?
Pipedrive. Yeah, so they're a younger company and I think they just raised a Series C or something. But I love it for the the really clear, I mean, it's called Pipe Drive, but their pipeline, the visualization of that and the reporting we get out of it and forecasting.
All right, a couple more. So favorite TV show. Do you guys have time for TV?
Not a lot. Community is mine.
Is that
cult,
show?
Cult like, classic, yeah. Oh, go watch it. It's great.
What, like, where did you see this?
I think it's on Stan now.
Okay.
Yeah. It's finished. It was, it's all done and dusted. Right. But five good seasons. Six seasons, something like that.
Noelle?
Ever. I didn't think about this.
You're just showing that you don't have time. You're too busy at work.
Yeah, like when I really family. Used to watch a lot of TV, Friends, but that's pretty old now. Still makes me laugh. Maybe The Office.
Yeah, okay, cool.
And I'm not quite sure UK or US. I think...
Both good.
Yeah, probably my favourite moment ever on TV was from The Office UK. So maybe we'll go with that.
All right, and then last one. So if you guys, I mean, maybe this is a joint thing. If you were to do a TED Talk on a particular topic, what would it be on? It doesn't have to be a joint thing, by the way. I'm just wondering if that's
What thing. Would I give a TED Talk on? Ooh.
I think mine would have to be something on culture.
It's obviously a passion point. I mean, if you're ever going to give a TED Talk, it's got to be from the heart.
Yeah. Passionate about it. I think we're really privileged to – we learn a lot from our clients about it. Maybe something about building a culture.
Then. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Or if not that, sometime in the future, something about being – transferred into the second version of an Android and what that's meant to me.
Okay.
Just, you know. Well, you know, this is one way to be immortal, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I agree.
But not the first version, never the first version.
Yeah. All right, guys, thank you. That was great. Really enjoyed that. Thanks for hosting us in Adelaide and thanks for being the first co-guests on the show. So...
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, everyone, for listening and to our sponsors. So, see you next time.
Bye.